Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
Today on the pod, the federal government is launching a new $6 billion infrastructure fund, but there are some strings attached.
Ontario's announced where it will be allocating international students, and private institutions are losing out.
2 years ago, Doug Ford and Stephen Del Duca bashed each other's brains in during a provincial election. You should see what they're saying about each other today.
And in your column, my column, I focus on what the feds can and cannot do on the housing file.
And I'll focus on a homeless encampment in Hamilton's City Hall Square and see if there's anything that can be done about that.
It's April 5th, 2024, so let's get to it.
Partner, good to see you again.
Good to see you, sir.
I see we are sticking with the space theme.
Yes. Had this one in the drawer at NASA. I suppose I should say, given who I work for, not my favorite government agency, but certainly a very close number two.
A close number two to what?
My employer, TVO.
There we go. Okay. Do you know what NASA stands for?
National Aeronautics and Space Administration.
Good for you, pal. I knew you'd know. I'm just setting you up to make you look good, which is not hard because you are good.
No, I mean, very grateful to TVO for 10 years of employment, but I have loved NASA for a lot longer.
Let me put it that way. I understand. We're not going to comment about this because we may have a little something to say about what I'm wearing later.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. And with that, let's head on to issue one. The federal government announced a new $6 billion infrastructure fund that will be part of its forthcoming budget. The fund is designed to get infrastructure built faster, but as we suggested off the top, there are strings attached to the money. JMM, take us through it.
So there's actually been quite a few substantial federal housing announcements in the last week. They are issuing the old idea of saving everything for budget day, and they're just pre-announcing a whole bunch of stuff, which I don't mind, actually. But what we are talking about immediately is the Canada Housing Infrastructure Fund. $1 billion will go towards improving things such as wastewater systems. The remainder, about $5 billion or so, will be negotiated among provinces and territories. But as is common with federal money, there are some strings attached, which may ruffle some feathers, particularly here in Ontario. One of the requirements that the federal government has talked about is requiring provinces to force municipalities to allow more buildings, such as fourplexes,
Uh-oh.
Which we've talked about recently.
Uh-oh.
Here's how Premier Doug Ford reacted to that.
See, the difference between ourselves and the federal government, and I want to work with them. I am working with them on a lot of different issues on a daily basis. I don't believe in forcing municipalities. I believe in working with municipalities. I've walked a mile in their shoes. Mayor Del Duca, he knows best where to put the housing, not the province, or for sure, not the federal government.
Wait a second. I think my head's about to... Did Premier Ford just say that the mayor of Vaughan, Stephen Del Duca, knows best?
That's what he said.
Okay, then I need to go on a little tangent here because the premier was up in Vaughan in York Region on Wednesday morning of this week announcing a new medical school for York University, and he had effusive praise, quite over the top actually, for the guy he went toe-to-toe with in a provincial election less than 2 years ago. Watch.
I also want to acknowledge my good pal, Mayor Del Duca. And I always say this. So I had, what do we have, 22 mayors at the house one time in the summer. And I called them out. I don't know if I embarrassed them, but I said, I wish every mayor was like Mayor Del Duca. He gets things done. He understands the system. And when he comes over the house, we sit outside, you know, in the solarium. But you should see how we smash a dozen cannolis back real quick. I'll tell you, between him and I, and they're great cannolis from Vaughn. He always brings a box of cannolis. And I bring the Tim Horton Timbits. So
he's having them over to his house now?
Apparently. I mean, I love a good Timbit, but I will say if Mayor Del Duca is bringing cannolis and Premier Ford is bringing Timbits, Mayor Del Duca is really bringing the better gift.
You're going with the cannolis.
Cannolis are good.
Yeah, I gotcha.
A change in tone
you
from
think?
The election, I think we could say. And yet, this is also a trend we have seen with the Premier before, where once the opposition leaders are out of provincial politics, he's able to, you know, mend fences with them. You know, we've seen it with clearly with Stephen Del Duca. We've seen it with Andrea Horvath, now mayor of Hamilton. We've seen it with Patrick Brown in Brampton. These are all people whom Ford has gone toe-to-toe with, in some cases in very acrimonious ways, while they were rivals in the provincial political scene. And now it's bygones.
Which is a beautiful thing in a way, because obviously you would like people to be able to sheathe their swords and do the public's business without previous entanglements affecting them. And apparently the feeling is mutual with Stephen Del Duca, who 2 years ago was saying that Doug Ford was unfit to be the premier of the province of Ontario. He's got a bit of a different tune now. Have a listen.
You know, I don't think it was that long ago, maybe a few years ago now, when a lot of people across Ontario would have found this scene, this very scene, me standing at a podium thanking Doug Ford. You didn't even wait for the punchline there. And I have to tell you, since becoming mayor of this city, I have found Premier Ford to be an extraordinarily accessible and welcoming partner on so many different fronts.
I mean, your head truly wants to explode with the, it just reminds me of my favorite line, you know, which is where you stand depends on where you sit. Yeah. And these guys are obviously sitting in different places right now. They used to go after each other, hammer and tong, and now they're BFFs. So go figure. Anyway, that aside, that little tangent aside, let's get back on the path. Doug Ford has made clear his feelings about fourplexes in the past few weeks, has not missed an opportunity to say that he doesn't think they're for this province. He's against. What about a three-year freeze on development charges? That was also included in the federal government announcement. Take us through some of that.
So this is an interesting one because while the federal government's announcement in theory applies to all provinces equally, not all provinces rely on development charges to the same extent that Ontario does. Some provinces are closer to us than others, but if you think of Quebec right next door, development charges are very, very minimal there. You know, municipal infrastructure still primarily paid for by property taxes or provincial grants, that kind of thing. Ontario relies on development charges much more than many other provinces, so freezing development charges by extension affects this province more than it would others. We have some estimates of how much total development charges are in Ontario. In 2018, municipalities collected approximately $2 billion from these charges that they used to, you know, build, in some cases, road and sewer infrastructure. In other cases, it's parks and libraries, that kind of thing.
That's not chump change. $2 billion is real money.
$2 billion a year is real money. Freezing those fees obviously could limit how much money cities are able to raise from new housing. And of course, the point to all of this policy is to try and get lots of new homes built. But I think it's important to say that, at least reading the federal announcement in its sort of plain meaning, they're not saying that fees should be cut or much less zeroed out. They're just saying, like, freeze them at the current level and don't increase them further. You know, in the city of Toronto, for example, development charges really have gone up quite a bit in certainly the last 10 years and even before that. So if everybody can sort of take a breath and just freeze development charges, I think the feds are arguing that that would be good to get more homes built in these municipalities.
Do I have this right that they've got until January 1st of next year to come to all these agreements? So how do we see all this rolling out?
Yeah, so they're going to work over the next year to hammer out these agreements. And I think, you know, if you think back to the agreements that the provinces came to on daycare, obviously people may remember that Ontario was relatively late to signing an agreement with the federal government on that one. I believe we were the last province or territory to do so. And we might see something similar again. 2025, of course, under current law, has to be a federal election year?
Maybe not.
Okay, well.
Maybe not. There's a loophole in that act. I was talking to some people about it last night. You just never know. They might go all 5 years. You never know.
Yes, so very briefly, we'll just say calling elections is a prerogative of the Crown, and there's an open debate as to whether fixed election dates can actually bind the crown in this kind of a way. I don't think we'll necessarily see that be tested, but honestly, I've been wrong before. Anyway, back to housing policy. We have seen, talking about negotiations with the provincial governments, we've already seen a lot of skepticism from largely provincial conservative premiers who, you know, predictably say that Ottawa is wading into matters of provincial jurisdiction. And they're not wrong. This is an area of provincial jurisdiction. I'd say the one notable exception here is British Columbia, which both, I would say, a lot of housing advocates would say BC has really been leading the pack in terms of changes to housing policy. And Housing Minister Ravi Kalon said earlier this week, I'm paraphrasing, basically, if other provinces don't want this money, BC is happy to take it. Yeah. One big question that we don't have an answer to yet is, despite the initiatives that have been announced today, or rather this week, I should say, how much wiggle room is the federal government willing to give other provinces? Is fourplexes everywhere a bright red line that the feds are going to really insist on? Or is there some room to negotiate? Our colleagues at the Trillium have reported that the Premier's office believes there is some room to negotiate, that Ontario might still get its share of this $5 or $6 billion. But, you know, that remains to be seen just exactly how much room there is to negotiate.
Well, we do remember several months ago, the Prime Minister himself said, you know, housing is a provincial responsibility. And he kind of got chastised for saying that. You are quite correct. The Constitution says it is a provincial responsibility. And yet here the feds are diving in deep. What do you think?
Well, so let me just add one caveat here. Of course, the Constitution is silent on the issue of housing, right? The housing involves areas of both federal and provincial jurisdiction. And I think the Prime Minister correctly said that a lot of what we talk about in housing is our areas of purely provincial jurisdiction. But, and we'll talk about this a bit more later in the your column, my column bit, but there are areas like banking regulation, which are absolutely tied up in federal power and housing. So on this matter of the federal government, let's call it trying to bribe the provinces into making good policy changes. You know, I like this idea, and I'm sort of honor bound to say that because in 2021, I wrote that the federal government should do exactly this. We remember that for a few years now, the federal government has been writing checks to municipalities, and federal housing minister Sean Fraser has done a few of these now, where they've convinced some of the larger municipalities in Canada to make substantial policy changes. And but when the government first announced this in 2021, I said, like, okay, it's a good idea. The provinces can make all of these changes faster, and they can make them more broadly than the federal government going by and, you know, having to negotiate with every single municipal council in Canada. The Liberal, this is called the Housing Accelerator Fund, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the other thing I will say is I could be wrong.
Has that happened before?
Oh, more times than I care to admit. You know, in 2021, I argued that it would be faster for the federal government to just bribe 10 provinces as opposed to hundreds of municipalities. But I was also more optimistic back then that even conservative provincial governments would be willing to take the money and make a bunch of what are like pro-market housing reforms. Mm-hmm. And instead what we've seen, I mean, with this example of Doug Ford and fourplexes, for example, and I think we're, you know, you can see some of this happening in other provinces as well, is conservatives sort of polarizing against some of these housing policies precisely because they are Justin Trudeau's ideas. Or in Ontario, we're talking about Bonnie Crombie as well, right? Conservatives are leaning against ideas that they perceive as liberal-coded, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is to wedge the other guy by taking a position on something and saying, if you're not for our very popular position, then you're obviously against, and therefore, anyway, you try and pigeonhole somebody in a corner. One thing we have not heard, we know what the debate is. We know that Trudeau and those who agree with him are for fourplexes. We know Doug Ford has come out very strongly against fourplexes, saying they're inconsistent with existing neighborhoods. We got some polling on this. Let's see what the people have to say.
We do. So a recent poll by Abacus Data gives us at least some data to work with. That firm asked respondents whether they supported so-called a gentle density on their block. So not just asking people whether they support the idea in theory, but would you be willing to support it, you know, very close to where you live, like in your backyard almost. They asked the question nationwide, but the Ontario numbers were basically 30% opposed, 37% supported gentle density, and 34% were neutral. So, well, you know, obviously it's not like super majority strong support for this policy. It's also not clear that there's a massive block of voters who are, you know, absolutely inimically opposed to this idea either.
No, it looks frankly like there's a whole, it's basically a third, a third, a third, because if you take the margin of error into account, it's basically a third, a third, a third, which suggests to me that there's a third of the people out there that are persuadable. And that means if you make a good argument, you can bring them onto your side. We know the premier's trying to make what he would see as a good argument. How's he doing with that?
Well, you know, we talked a bit about why the premier is opposed to fourplexes last week, and I'm not going to repeat too much there except to say that, you know, I think some of this is just, you know, his sincere belief about, you know, how we should treat communities and the community that he comes out of as an Etobicoke resident and a longtime Etobicoke politician. One other thing that I didn't mention last week that I want to sort of key in on here is that Doug Ford, you know, started in municipal politics. And that's a very common story for a lot of MPPs, right? Mm-hmm. You get started in municipal politics and then you make your way to Queen's Park. And while I don't think that planning politics are like super important in the in most provincial elections, right? I don't think a government wins or loses an election based on planning politics most of the time. In municipal politics, where the elections are smaller and they are generally lower turnout, you know, a few hundred people in your ward who are really angry about, you know, some tower that got approved or something like that, they can absolutely swing an election. And so I think one of the things you do see is people learning that lesson early on in their political career and then carrying it with them to Queen's Park in a way that maybe isn't actually properly adapted to the new political context they're in. Mm.
That's a great debate that will continue. And in the meantime, we are on to issue two. Okay, we know the federal government recently dramatically cut back the number of visas they were prepared to grant to foreign students to come to study in Canada. And that meant Ontario's public and private colleges and universities were anxiously awaiting to see how the visas were going to be allocated. The news for private colleges is very tough.
Basically, almost all of the visas are going to go to students who will be enrolled in the public post-secondary system, like upwards of 95%. There's been a lot of concern about the private career colleges offering, don't want to be defamatory here, but like, you know, the concern is that they've been offering a substandard education and that they've in fact been exploiting international students. Mm-hmm. Federal Immigration Minister Mark Miller referred to them as puppy mills and not in an affectionate I love puppy kind of ways. Mm-hmm.
One of the things I find interesting about this is that we know Doug Ford is a champion of the private sector. He is a progressive conservative premier, and he often puts the accent on the conservative part of the name of his party. But pretty clearly here, the public post-secondary system is being favored with this visa situation, and the premier is not going to bat for the private system, which I don't know if there's an explanation behind it, but I find it intriguing. Let's put it that way.
No, it is intriguing. At that press conference in Vaughan the other day, the premier said he'd like to prioritize Ontario students going to Ontario universities and colleges and would like to get rid of the 18% or so of enrollment who are international students. You know, removing those visa slots from career colleges is, I think, going to have a very clear and immediate impact as a good way to reduce the number of international students. But, you know, just to put this back in context, I mean, part of the incentive for private colleges, but also public sector colleges and universities to rely on international students is because of the tuition cap mm-hmm. that this government has initially imposed and now maintained for 5 or 6 years now without being able to raise money from that 82%, I guess, of enrollment who are domestic students. They rely very heavily on international students whom they can charge whatever they want. And now, I think, you know, obviously the government had announced money in the budget to support the post-secondary sector. We still don't know exactly how things are going to play out in the sector for the next several years. I mean, I think everybody acknowledges, even with the provincial funding in the last budget, it's going to be a lean few years in Ontario's colleges and universities.
Oh, no question. They're looking at $3 billion in cuts over the next couple of years. So some rubber's going to hit the road in a very harsh way. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, no, it's, yeah, we will keep an eye on it, but it's going to be tough.
For sure. And with that, on to issue three. We just wanted to do a quick by-election check-in because Ontarians in two ridings are waiting to find out when they can replace two MPPs who have left Queen's Park for greener pastures. And we found out this week. So tell us about, this is a long riding name, Lambton, Kent, Middlesex in southwestern Ontario, and then Milton, just about an hour from here.
Right. So the two by-elections for those ridings have been called, or because we love to use the technical formal language here, writs have been issued.
The writs have been issued, not dropped, everybody. They have been issued. We've talked about this before.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
So under the Election Act, elections must be called on a Wednesday and held on the fifth Thursday after the date of the announcement.
We all knew that.
Yes. Yeah. Who doesn't know stuff like this? They also have to be called no later than 6 months after a vacancy occurs in the legislature. And in this case, the government waited about as long as it legally could to call the by-election in Lambton, Kent, Middlesex, which was the riding that was vacated by former Labour Minister Monty McNaughton back in October. Actually, I just checked the dates yesterday while we were working on this, and he waited until October 3rd so that he served exactly 12 years, I think.
In the legislature.
It was because he was sworn in on October 3rd, 2011, and resigned on October 3rd, 2023.
12 years to the day.
I believe so.
There's something poetic about that. I'm not sure what it is, but something.
So with the by-elections called on the day they were, the voting day will be May 2nd, just about a month away.
How, I mean, I know this is a cliched question, but the reality is by-elections are either extremely crucial, very important, a sign of the times, or they mean nothing. So let's figure it out. Let's have that discussion here.
Right. So just mathematically, these by-elections cannot affect the status of the Ford government's majority in the legislature. They could lose both seats and it would not affect their majority is still large enough that they would still control the legislature. Made a bit of a crack about this last week as well, but it also can't change the status of the Liberal Party. Were they to win both seats, they would still be one seat short of recognized party status in the legislature. Nevertheless, you know, by-elections can be useful signals for political parties. It's a chance for voters to sort of take a little poke at the government in a context where it doesn't threaten to trigger a general election or a massive change in government policy or anything like that. It's just it's a way for voters to, you know, maybe turn on the check engine light for the government. Mm-hmm. And you know, hey, here's some things you need to pay attention to. You know, I think of when Raymond Cho won in, oh gosh, what was that now, 2017, maybe 2016. But it was viewed at the time by the Liberal government as a sign that the electricity issue could no longer be ignored. And after that by-election win, they became much more focused on really trying to bore down on the issue of electricity prices. So that's the kind of thing that can happen. We'll see what happens with the results of these by-elections. But, you know, they can surprise both political parties in the legislature. They can also surprise observers like us. You know, we saw the recent Green win in Kitchener Centre.
Yeah.
That was one that I think even a few weeks before it happened, it's not necessarily the outcome that you would have predicted.
Took that seat from the NDP.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, the Liberal win in Kanata-Carleton not too long ago with Karen McCrimmon. You know, that was an interesting case where the former Progressive Conservative had left suddenly and there was a lot of local issues. Oh, I will say, actually, I mean, I know I just said in the last segment that, you know, local super specific planning matters don't always shift elections, but in that Kanata-Carleton by-election, the issue of whether a golf course should be redeveloped into housing was actually one of the big issues for that by-election. In Milton, one of the things that they will be talking about is, I believe it's a proposed landfill or a quarry.
The quarry, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, by-elections are those cases where those super local issues really can matter a great deal.
And I was just going to say, the interpretation matters a lot, too, because these are two seats formerly held by the Conservatives. If the Conservatives hold these seats, a lot of people will be tempted to say, oh, no story here. They were Conservative seats. They are still Conservative seats. You do have to dive into the numbers, though, because if the Liberals are unusually competitive in losing in the Southwestern Ontario one, that might be a sign of something. Or if they, you know, if they do well in Milton, again, even in a losing effort, in a seat held by a former Conservative cabinet minister, you know, that may portend something. So you never know.
No, absolutely. And, you know, the difference between losing by 20 points versus losing by 5 points.
You can spin that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's easy to get lost in the crosstabs sometimes when you're like reading polls too closely. And people can sort of write whatever story they want in some cases.
Well, let me jump in with this. Do we have any polling on any of these races?
So glad you asked, Steve. We do, in fact, have a recent poll this week from Liaison Strategies, and it's functionally a statistical tie in Milton and a substantial Tory lead in Lambton, Kent, Middlesex, which, I mean, I won't necessarily speak for you, but it's about what I would have expected going into this. I think we are generally expecting Milton to be more competitive than the seat in Southwestern Ontario. McNaughton had held that seat for a very long time.
12 years to the day, I hear.
Yes, indeed. And he was a very popular MPP for that riding. And, I, you know, it's the kind of riding where, to be blunt, the Liberals have struggled ever since the 2011 election.
And yet Bonnie Crombie was there. She's gone in there the past, I don't know if it was last weekend, but the weekend before that, she was in there door knocking. So they're not giving up on it.
No, no. And this is why I say, you know, the difference between losing by 20 points or losing by 5 points, I mean, that'll be the kind of thing that we're looking at in Lambton, Kent, Middlesex.
Right on. Okay, up next, our favorite op-eds from the past week. Okay, it's time now for a little feature we like to call Your Column, My Column, in which JMM and I reminisce about some of the columns that we wrote this past week. And before I ask you what you wrote about, I want to tell you a little story here. Because I had a couple of nights ago, I was at McMaster University in Hamilton at a place called Wilson College doing a panel discussion about leadership and young people and advice and how they can get involved in politics and leadership, that kind of stuff. And after it was over, I was out in the foyer just sort of mingling with people. And two young people, I want to get their names right, Haley Kapinski and Ori Epstein, who are students there, came up to me. And it was one of those kind of fanboy moments. They were looking at me like, I don't know. I don't know how to describe it other than to say, they both came up to me and said, we love your podcast.
Oh,
we love the On Poly podcast, and they love you, and they want. And so I said, kids, you make sure you listen this week because we're going to give you a shout out, and we're grateful that you're listening. So Haley and Ori, two thumbs up from the both of us here. So that having been said, what do you got for this week?
So we've already talked about some of the federal housing announcements, but I wrote earlier this week about one of the previous announcements. The government is intending to bring in a charter of tenants' rights, a rental charter of rights, if you will. Unfortunately, I have to be sort of the wet blanket, and I wrote about how I don't expect this to amount to much because this is one of those areas where we are talking about something that is exclusively provincial jurisdiction, and the federal government can try and entice provinces to play along with something like this. But as we've already seen with the fourplex issue, particularly the conservative premiers across Canada, not just Doug Ford, they are not making it easy, let me put it that way, for the federal government. And I'm skeptical that this is going to amount to much before the next federal election. There are other measures that, you know, I mentioned banking, and the federal government has also announced that they want to see renters get credit on their credit scores, get points basically for rental payments that are made on time. Currently, I own a home, I make mortgage payments. Every payment that I make on time is counted towards my credit score. If I were a renter, that would not be the case. The federal government would like that to change. Hmm. And they do directly regulate banks. So in theory, that's something that they can really pull a lever on, except that the specific instrument that they are using is not something that actually compels the banks to do anything. It's all voluntary compliance, if I could put it that way. So even there, a measure where I think you could say that Ottawa really has a direct lever to pull, we'll see how effective it actually is.
That's a very McGrath column. Deep in the weeds of nerddom.
You know, I have a brand to maintain.
Well, this past week, let me start by saying this. You know, I'm born and raised in Hamilton, and I go...
It's come up a few times.
It's come up a few times. I go in most weekends and visit my dad, who still lives there. He lives right near City Hall in downtown Hamilton. And we went out for a walk a couple of weekends ago, and we walked by City Hall. And if you have not done that in Hamilton lately, you will be shocked by what you find. There is a tent city, in effect, that has taken over City Hall Square because there are a lot of homeless people in Hamilton who have nowhere to live, and they have decided, I think in part to make a political point, that that's where they're going to live. And so, you know, I said to my dad, let's walk over and talk to some of the folks there, which we did. And I met a 35-year-old woman named Amanda who lives in a tent in that square with her boyfriend. And we had, I don't know, 15, 20-minute conversation about why she's there. I asked her what percentage of the people living in City Hall Square are facing addiction and mental health issues. She said 100%. She's one of them. She had what you might call a very nice, normal life once upon a time. Lived in a nice apartment, 3 kids, married, had a nice job. Something happened. She's now got addiction issues that she needs to deal with. She ended up, you know, this is truly a portrait of homelessness that that I think the column that I've written helps us understand it better. You know, she lost her apartment through rent eviction. She couch surfed with a couple of friends for a few months and then ended up on the street and now is at City Hall Square. And, you know, there was a time when she was living in a park in the North End. And I think she said she saw 1 shooting, 4 stabbings, somebody get a hatchet in the head. 4 tents set on fire. There were 2 rival drug gangs who were trying to have control of the drug trade in that area. And they were basically at war with each other. And these poor homeless folks were caught in the middle of this whole thing. So anyway, the column focuses on Amanda, her efforts to get some serious housing. You're going to forgive me for saying this, but it's a terrible image for Hamilton to see all those tents in City Hall Square as you walk into City Hall. It's not a good look for the city. So I think bottom line, a lot of decision makers need to be a lot more imaginative in what they do there, because the status quo stinks, I can tell you that.
Can I get on a soapbox
Please,
for a moment
go
here?
Ahead.
There are millions of possible explanations for homelessness that people will glom onto. You know, I have reported from Toronto City Hall in a prior part of my career, and people will talk about all of them. The academic research on this is reasonably clear that homelessness is primarily a problem of housing scarcity.
Yeah.
That when housing is too expensive, everybody bids for wherever they can in the housing sector, and the poorest people are simply pushed out of housing altogether. And the places where it, like, yes, there are drug and mental health issues, but the places where drug addiction is the worst are not the places with the worst homelessness. Places where mental health outcomes are the worst are not the places with the worst rates of homelessness. The places where housing is the most expensive are the places with the worst homelessness.
Yeah.
And that includes Toronto, that includes Hamilton, that includes basically all of Canada's large cities at this point. And so there are any number of reasons for us to get serious and more serious about housing policy. The homelessness problems in Canadian cities are just one of the most visible ones.
Well, I got to say as well, Haley and Ori, who I was talking to at McMaster the other day, when I said, why do you listen to the podcast? What do you like? You know, I'm doing a little focus group. What do you like? What do you don't like? And they said, we like the your column, my column. You guys talk about your columns, and then we actually go to the website, look them up, and read them. So if you want to know why we do this, that's why we do this. Okay. And with that, shall we go to the mailbag?
Let's go to the mailbag.
Let's do it. If you've got a burning question or insightful comment, then send it along to onpolitics@tvo.org. And JMM, why don't you kick us off this week?
Absolutely. We have an email from listener Nick Spohr in Toronto who writes, hi there. I ran as provincial candidate in the former Halton riding in the 2011 and 2014 provincial elections prior to it being named Milton, both times against Liberal Indira Naidoo-Harris. Indira was always a joy to have as a competitor, and she is a lovely person. I also distinctly remember getting out the vote on election day in Milton and seeing Zee Hamid working the same street for the Liberals. He is now, of course, going to be the PC candidate.
Yes.
It's funny how the world works sometimes. In the latest edition, you missed out on a golden fun fact to tie together the Milton by-election story, and I really like this. Steve had guessed that it was E.C. Drury who was the last premier not to hold a seat at the time of winning an election. Drury did not run in the 1919 election and had to run in a by-election in 1920 to claim a seat. And which riding was that in? Halton.
Aha!
In fact, a Milton High School was named in Drury's honor because of this, which many of my friends had attended and a member of my former campaign staff even taught at. I graduated from Milton District High School.
How about that?
Keep up the fun facts, Nick Spohr.
This is why I love our listeners. You know, they are so smart, and although we know a few things about Ontario politics, we don't know everything.
Absolutely.
And they fill in the blanks. That is beautiful. Nick, great letter. Thank you so much for that.
Okay, and now we have an email from listener Wendy Feldman, also in Toronto, who writes, "Hi, I'm the proud parent of a recent university grad who just started paying back a student loan from OSAP. In May 2023, the federal government waived interest fees on its loans through the National Student Loan Service. Several provinces did the same. British Columbia, Manitoba, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island, and Newfoundland and Labrador do not charge interest on the provincial portion of their student loans. Hmm. Why does Ontario still charge students interest on OSAP, that's the Ontario Student Assistance Program, OSAP loans at prime plus 1%, or about 8% at the moment? Love the show, Wendy."
Okay, good question there. Let's do a little background here. Back in May 2023, the federal government, as we heard, eliminated the interest portion on the students' loans that they're responsible for. Ontario, as she said, has not done the same. Premier Ford could, if he wanted to, eliminate the provincial portion of interest on OSAP loans. Why doesn't he?
The premier and his government did cut tuition rates at the outset of their government early on in 2019. They have kept those tuition rates frozen for the ensuing 5 years. That's not without its problems, as we talked about. The government would say those are clear savings for the students. It is possible to pay off the OSAP portion of the loan first, so essentially eliminate the chunk of debt that is the interest-bearing debt. As for why they are not eliminating it entirely, as other provinces have, well, I mean, those kinds of policies do have costs, right? The government is literally banking on having that stream of income come in from Ontario students. And we've talked before, I think, about Finance Minister Peter Bethlenfalvy, and one of the lines I've used about him is that he really is a finance minister who believes that if you watch the pennies, the dollars take care of themselves. Mm-hmm. And so while this amount of money that we're talking about in the provincial budget is not like a huge sum, and it's not going to make the difference between a deficit or a surplus in 2026. He really does believe that you don't sort of give away even small sums like that without a very good reason. And clearly, the Ford government is not convinced of any of the reasons right now.
And yet he'll give away $7 billion to subsidize people electricity. You knew I was about to say that. Anyway, there we go. I'm back on my soapbox. Sorry about that. Okay, keep her going.
Right. We received, speaking of the hydro rebate, we received a bunch of emails last week about your proposal, your irritation. About
Screed.
The provincial hydro rebate. I'm going to highlight this one from listener Matthew Adams from Newcastle, about an hour east of Toronto, who writes, "Hello, Steve. I'm wondering if this $8 refund on hydro is one of those things that would cost more to means test than just to give it to everyone. I believe there are quite a few programs that are means tested so that once you look at how much it costs to exclude people, you realize it would actually be cheaper just to give them the money. Just a thought I'm sure you've had, but I wonder if it holds water here."
Matthew, thanks for that. It's a very fair question, and I've looked into that. I've asked finance officials and experts about whether it is too complicated to means test these subsidies and whether it's cheaper just to give it to everybody. And the answer is, apparently, no, it's not. It's not complicated or expensive at all. The government can claw back subsidies from higher income individuals on their tax returns. It is easy peasy lemon squeezy. And until some government does that, we're going to continue to spend $7.3 billion subsidizing the hydro bills for a lot of people who don't need, or I might even say deserve, the help. And I say that as one of those people. I don't need the $8 to $9 a month to help subsidize my hydro bills. So Okay, that's I know. I gotta
I'm just
get
gonna
over
give
it.
You a minute to get the blood pressure back down.
Thank you. Focus, focus, focus. Okay.
Calm blue ocean.
Yeah.
All right. We have another email from Brian with an I, Lewis.
Okay.
Who writes? Thanks for the identity clarification last week. Even if I feel bad to disappoint Steve that it was not the former NHL referee commenting on the podcast. Also, kudos on the budget coverage. Really respect the in-depth understanding and reporting on so many important and complex issues. It was great to hear JMM talk about social assistance amounts that are not indexed. I would add that the cost of living at the poverty line has risen about 20% since 2018, the last time these amounts were increased. And you'll like this, Steve. I also share Steve's grievances over the massive cost to the taxpayers of electricity subsidies, which surely the government could commit to gently phasing out.
Gently phasing out or eliminating all of, I don't know, they could figure that out. Anyway, that is Brian Lewis, who's the former chief economist, assistant deputy minister in the Office of Economic Policy in the Ontario Ministry of Finance, where he was from 2015 to 21. Not the Brian with a Y, Lewis, the former National Hockey League referee. And naturally, Brian with an I, you are totally right about the electricity subsidy, and we are on the same page on that one. Now, finally, we have something special. We have not emails, we have actual mail.
Actual physical mail.
Physical mail. A mailbag. JMM, will you look at that? It's a mailbag. Do you want to open up the mailbag and see what's in there?
Oh, sure.
Take a look.
So this is a letter from Paul Vanderham in Mississauga, Ontario.
Beautiful.
Put that down there. Is that okay? And shall I read or?
All yours.
Okay. Dear JMM and SP, as a lifelong nerd, I take umbrage with Steve Paikin's assertion that Highway 17 starts in Nipigon from your March 22nd podcast. Highway 17, also known as the Trans-Canada Highway, historically ran from the Quebec border to the Manitoba border, a distance of 2,129 kilometers, according to the Provincial Highways Distance Table 1989. A section of Highway 17 east of Ottawa was downloaded to the regional municipality of Ottawa-Carleton and the counties of Prescott and Russell in the late 1990s. Ottawa has since rebranded their portion as Road 174. At present, the eastern terminus of Highway 17 is somewhere west of Arnprior in Renfrew County, where the current provincial government's program of twinning the highway and rebranding it as Highway 417 continues at a bucolic pace.
Bucolic.
I love the word
nice.
Bucolic.
It's a great word.
As a gift, I have enclosed two copies of Ontario's official roadmap from the Bill Davis era.
Oh my gosh, look at these.
You will note that the earlier version from the late 1970s is unilingual, and the later version from the early 1980s is bilingual. Kind regards, Paul Vanderham, who I believe is a PA, so that's professional engineer?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly right. Okay. Obviously, this, first of all, thank you for that letter. This is great. We love when our even when they disagree with me, I think it's great.
And we should say that you are wearing the Highway 17 sweater is a total coincidence.
Completely coincidental. I had no idea this letter was coming.
Yes.
And I wore this a few weeks ago, and I mentioned that 17 North, which is what this sweater says, starts in Nipigon, goes all the way to the western border of Ontario in Kenora.
Yes.
And there's a difference. Well, do I put it this way? There's a difference of opinion as to whether 17, which of course goes all the way, as he says, from Eastern Ontario all the way up through and past, and then that's how I get to Manitoulin Island when I go west from Sudbury and so on. Yeah, but there's 17 North as distinguished from just 17. Now, I suspect technically he's right, and I suspect it's all 17 now, and they don't make a distinction between North, South, East, West, whatever. But since my sweatshirt says 17 North, I'm just trying to be consistent with what it says here.
Yes.
So are we going to cut me some slack here?
Well, I will cut you some slack, and I will note to our readers that, I mean, you mentioned your camp on Manitoulin, and your love of Northern Ontario is sincere and earned by many years of service.
So, of course.
This is not an issue of you trying to leave anybody out.
Perish the thought. Perish the thought. All right. Anyway, this is fabulous. Do you remember before GPS, you probably don't.
I do.
Do you remember these? You actually had to get these maps out and you had to open them up. And when you were driving the car and you had these maps open in front of you and you were trying to see where you were going while at the same time not getting into a car accident, let me tell you something. That was challenging, but this is very nice and nostalgic.
I do not own a car right now, as we've talked about before, but I did briefly own a car when I was in university, and it was just before like Google Maps became really like reliable and useful. And so, yes, I did own, I think it might still have it on a shelf somewhere, a Province of Ontario highway map.
As everyone should. That is the On Poly podcast for this April 5th, 2024.
You can follow our show on Apple Podcasts, and you can watch the video version of the podcast on the TVO Today YouTube channel.
Any feedback you have, we're happy to hear it, good, bad, or indifferent. Write us an email at onpolitics@tvo.org and be sure to include your first and last name and where you're writing from.
This week's episode was produced and edited by Matthew O'Mara, video editing by Colin Kish.
Production support from Jonathan Halliwell, Christine Gardner, Vito Tagarelli, Jeff Gusera, and Jennifer DeRosa.
Our managing editor is Katie O'Connor. Lori Few is the executive producer of digital. John Ferry is vice president, programming and content.
And special thanks to the studio crew here for making the show look so good, for our video podcast. And hi to everybody as well who's still listening to us the old-fashioned way on audio. Until next Friday, bye-bye.
See you next week.
You know, now I'm thinking, should I change this? 2 years ago, Doug Ford and Stephen Del Duca bashed each other's brains in during a provincial election. Is that too strong?
Yeah.
It's not too strong?
I mean, I don't think so. But
okay.